From the Radio Ranch in the heart of Liberty, Texas, it's the Bombastic Blogcast for Wednesday, February 5th, 2025. I'm the G-Man, Dan Gallo.
Hey, G-Man.
Hey there yourself. Defender of the peace, keeper of the justice, purveyor of truth, the kid with the patriotic red, white, and blue eyes, and one heck of a nice guy. What do you say we get things officially launched with
the Daily Denogram?
Oh yeah, words of wisdom, words of inspiration, brain droppings, or noggin nuggets, you get to make the call. Like this. It says, handy guide to modern science. Number one, if it's green or it wiggles, it's biology. Two, if it stinks, it's chemistry. Three, if it doesn't work, it's physics. Yeah. And number four, if it defies reason, it's politics.
The United States government would never have, our president had not, and as far as I know, that's the way it'll always be. Is that clear?
Let's move along now to the so-called educational part of this big blogcast.
Twisted History.
Oh boy.
Gather around, kids, because a lot of things happen on this day throughout history.
I hope so.
Some cool, some not so cool.
This is a waste of
time.
Just
the same. You need to know your Twisted History.
All righty.
You might be quizzed.
Yeah. You just let me know when. All right, kids, it was on this day in 1907, Belgian chemist Leo Baekeland announced the creation of Bakelite, which was the world's first synthetic plastic. And when I was a kid, we had a Bakelite phone. My dad had a Bakelite radio. I remember that. It was there on top of his workbench. See, that stuff was heavy. If you dropped your phone on your foot, you could lose it. Your foot, not the phone. Stuff was hard. And it was on this day in 1958, a hydrogen bomb known as the Tybee Bomb was lost by the U.S. Air Force off the coast of Savannah, Georgia, never to be recovered. Man, if that thing ever goes off, grab your surfboard because you're in for a ride. Surf's up, dude.
You're so weird.
When all is said and done, my friend, after all the politicking and all the rhetoric and all the speeches are made and everything, what it comes down to is U.S. manufacturing. When you return manufacturing jobs to the country, then your economy is on the road to recovery. And U.S. manufacturing's sector expanded in January, marking its first growth after more than 2 years of contraction, serious contraction too, by the way. And the talk is that optimism about the year ahead, the outlook for production, has soared, partly due to hopes that President Trump's policies would improve business conditions. Now, okay, when you're talking about business, you're talking about something. It's like reaching out with your hand and trying to grab a chunk of air. Okay, that's probably the best way that I can describe that. So the Institute for Supply Management, the ISM, reported just, what was that, on Monday, that its Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index, the PMI, rose to 50.9% in January, up from 49.2% in December. Now, a PMI above 50% indicates expansion in the manufacturing sector. Got that? Okay, so Timothy Fiore, who's the chair of the ISM Manufacturing Business Survey Committee, said in a statement, U.S. manufacturing activity expanded in January after 26 consecutive months of contraction. Demand clearly improved while output expanded and inputs remained accommodative. Well, similarly, S&P Global reported on Monday that its U.S. manufacturing PMI rose to 51.2 in January, up from 49.4 in December, marking the first time in 7 months that that gauge rose above the key barrier of 50, which separates growth from contraction. So both output and new orders returned to growth in January, while optimism in the year-ahead outlook for production actually soared to a 34-month high, driven by one of the largest monthly confidence gains ever recorded by the survey. So what we're talking about here is something that's really big. Chris Williamson, as chief business economist at S&P Global Market Intelligence, said in a statement, quote, manufacturers report that political uncertainty has cleared. I like that. Manufacturers report that political uncertainty has cleared and the pro-business approach from the new administration has brightened their prospects. See, over the past decade, only 2 months during the post-COVID-19 pandemic economic reopening have seen a comparable improvement in business confidence. Now, a combination of higher new orders and improving business confidence meant that manufacturers increased their staffing levels for the third month running, according to S&P Global. And the pace of job creation was the highest since June. Now, with improved demand and production, employment actually expanded, according to the ISM report. I haven't seen any recent employment figures. It'll be interesting to start seeing those again. But now, there's with something like this, there's always a caveat, right? The recovery is not without risks. The ISM report highlighted concerns about rising input costs, with the prices index jumping 2.4 points to 54.9% in January from 52.5% the previous month. See, January marked the fourth consecutive month of price increases, with 21% of companies reporting higher prices that month compared to 14% in December. See, so there's always that you have to balance everything against, the prices. So Fiore said that maintaining a slower rate of price increases as demand returns is going to be a major challenge for this entire year. Likewise, the S&P Global report noted that input costs continued to rise in January, leading the pace of output price inflation to accelerate for the third straight month to its highest level in nearly a year. So the trick here, my friend, there's a lot more to this story, but I'm not going to bore you with it. The trick here is to keep an increase in manufacturing going, of course. But we also have to manage the prices, the input to that manufacturing. And that is a real balancing act. But we've done it before, and I'm betting that with this administration, we're going to do it again. As I mentioned yesterday, Zelensky wants to know where the rest of the money is, or something like $177 billion earmarked for more aid to Ukraine, and he's only got about $75 billion, wants to know where the rest of the money is, and of course I kind of bristled at reading that, as I'm sure you're bristling hearing about it. But our president is now demanding some compensation from Ukraine for our involvement and for all the money that we've been sending them. Just to quote him from something he said Monday, he says, we're handing them money hand over fist. We're giving them equipment. We're looking to do a deal with Ukraine where they're going to secure what we're giving them with their rare earth and other things. I want to have security of rare earth. And that was an apparent reference to rare earth elements, you know, which refers to, it refers to a specific group of materials that are only deposited in relatively small quantities and can be used in a variety of applications, particularly electronics, healthcare stuff, batteries, battery technology, you get the idea. So, anyhow, Trump had previously said that he'd bring about a rapid end to the war. And he said talks are ongoing to bring this conflict to a close. I think that's what everybody really wants, except, of course, Zelensky, because Zelensky is profiting handsomely with this war. And the longer the war goes on, the richer Zelensky gets. But Trump said, we made a lot of progress on Russia, Ukraine. We'll see what happens. We're going to stop that ridiculous war. And it is ridiculous. Zelensky told the Associated Press back on Saturday that any negotiations between the U.S. and Russia, but without his country, were unacceptable. I understand that. I don't think there's anything unreasonable about that. But to quote him, Zelensky, he said, "They may have their own relations, but talking about Ukraine without us is dangerous for everyone." Well, it's dangerous for everyone in Ukraine, perhaps. But right now, I don't see that Zelensky has a lot of room for making any demands, because he's been fighting that war strictly on our dime. And you see, the thing that angers me about this, I hate using that word anger. How about I should just say pisses me off, okay? The thing that pisses me off about this is the fact that you and I, as taxpayers, have no say in this. By the time you hear this, President Trump has probably already issued a series of executive actions to dismantle the Department of Education. And this is according to a report from the Washington Post. But Trump had previously promised to abolish the department. He was going to do it outright. Did this back, was talking about it back when he was on the campaign trail, pointing to its record of incredible inefficiency over the past several decades. But that's what happens in government. You know that our government, the U.S. government, is the single largest employer in our entire country. Now, that can't be. Not to be a successful nation financially. And we're not. We're broke. This country's broke. Now, according to the report, which cited multiple people familiar with the order, funny how they don't have names, Trump's executive action acknowledges that Congress has the authority to abolish the department outright. And as a result, Trump is reportedly going to be enacting a series of policies that will work to dismantle the education department from within by redirecting funding and reducing its workforce. And that's where you really need to start, is reduce the workforce. Because once you have a healthy operating, and by healthy, I mean a bloated, healthy operating government organization, it does nothing but grow. Some grow faster than others, but they grow. They don't shrink. They never inherently shrink. You never hear, "Well, we have more than enough people in the department now, so we can cut back. Let's send layoff notices." That's not how government works. And you know where we really cut ourselves in the jugular years ago was when we allowed the government to unionize. I mean, that was a financial suicide right there. So the work is continuing in the Department of Education, but Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, you know, DOGE, that initiative has deployed 20 staffers to focus on the Department of Education. And DOGE staffers are currently looking for ways to cut spending and staff. Three people familiar with the matter were talking to the Washington Post about it. And one senior White House official confirmed that DOGE's work is a prelude to executive action that's expected to be implemented later this month. Now, what form that's going to take, I don't know, but the order is expected to direct the Education Department to develop a legislative plan to present to Congress. And this White House official said that it's also going to instruct the department to come up with a plan to cut down on staff and reduce its functions. Now, specifics of the order remain unknown, at least right now. That could change in hours. Though people briefed on the president's plan expect several education department duties to be transferred to different departments. And I'm sorry, but that kind of thing just doesn't impress me. But here again, you know, we screwed ourselves as a nation when we allowed government employees to unionize. And I'm sure, I see nothing in front of me here that says that this is the case. But I'm sure that's a major consideration. A plan drafted by the Heritage Foundation earlier suggested that the student loan program should move to the Treasury Department, while civil rights enforcement would move to the Department of Justice. But these changes would also likely require congressional action. So Republican lawmakers have reportedly asked the president to wait until his nominee for Education Department Secretary, Linda McMahon, testifies before the U.S. Senate for her confirmation hearing. Yeah, you need to put the horse in front of the cart in this particular case, I guess. But scheduling for the hearing has currently been delayed as staffers for the Government Ethics Office reviews her paperwork. And it's unlikely that Congress would agree to abolish the Department of Education outright. I mean, they don't do that sort of thing. What? Abolish? Close up a government organization? A government department? We can't do that. So that kind of legislation would require a supermajority of 60 votes in the Senate, meaning at least 7 Democrats would need to support the bill. Freudian slip. The possibility of this happening is viewed as next to impossible. So, we all know that. That's the way government works. And government doesn't work. I'm having to deal with the government right now on behalf of a friend. And every time I try to contact them so that I can go in to their offices and talk with them, instead, I get an email back saying, go here. And they give me a website to go to. So the people in the government do not want to talk with us. They don't want to deal with us. They would rather deal through text messages or emails or the internet, but no more face-to-face meetings. Our government, my friend, is very, very broken. Chris Powell, writing in Trending Politics, says that investigators analyzing the black box data from the crashed aircraft in D.C. from last week have uncovered a significant discrepancy that could provide some crucial insight into the cause of the collision. Now, initial findings from the investigation between this American Airlines CRJ-700 jet and the U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter near D.C., which claimed 67 lives, indicate an important altitude discrepancy at the time of the accident. Now, according to the jet's flight recorder, it was flying at roughly 325 feet. That's the airliner we're talking about here. While the control tower's data placed the helicopter at 200 feet. Now, this 125-foot difference is now under scrutiny by the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, because they're looking to understand its impact on the incident. What caused this thing? Now, investigators are delving into the conflicting altitude readings from the recent collision, exploring several potential causes. I mean, this is a painstaking forensic examination, and they're examining whether there were errors in the reported altitudes, if the helicopter might have surpassed its maximum allowed altitude of 200 feet for its flight path, and the impact of the crew's use of night vision goggles. Now, recorded alerts from air traffic control to both the helicopter and the airplane, along with the aircraft's last-second evasive actions, are being analyzed to further understand the dynamics of the incident. Now, NTSB member Todd Inman said, that's what our job is, to figure that out. And according to the Daily Mail, Mr. Inman was showing some frustration with reporters pressing for details on the altitude discrepancies. Because quite frankly, they're asking him for stuff that he doesn't have, information that he doesn't readily have at that particular moment. But investigators are attempting to align the differing altitude readings with data from the helicopter's black box, which has been delayed due to the recorder being waterlogged after falling into the Potomac. So Inman said that he says, well, let me quote him here. He says, we currently don't have the readout from the Black Hawk, so we can't provide information about the altitude at which the helicopter was flying. obviously an impact occurred, and I would say when impact occurs, that's typically where the altitude of both aircraft were at the moment. Duh. Of course. And then he said, some wanted to give us hugs, some are just mad and angry. They're just all hurt, and they still want answers, and we want to give them answers. Our job is to find the facts. More importantly, our job is to make sure this tragedy doesn't happen again, regardless of what anyone may be saying. And he's got a good point there because, yeah, the surviving family members and friends, they want answers, and they want those answers right now because they want to at least have some closure. They want to feel better. But unfortunately, the information these guys are, you know, the NTSB are sifting through isn't easy to come by. Just getting the black box alone sometimes can be an almost impossible task. Because the black boxes or flight recorders are absolutely essential for investigating aircraft incidents. They consist of two devices. You got the flight data recorder, which logs flight parameters like speed, altitude, and engine performance. And then you've got the cockpit voice recorder, which captures pilot conversations and cockpit sounds. And despite their name, they're actually bright orange boxes for visibility, you know, when you have to dig through mud to find them. And they're built to withstand very extreme conditions. They endure high-impact crashes. They can survive fires and deep-sea pressure. And they're equipped with underwater locator beacons. They emit signals for up to 30 days to aid recovery. So, fellow by the name of Bryce Banning, the NTSB investigator in charge, said this is a complex investigation. There are lots of pieces here. Our team is working hard to gather this data. And then he further detailed the critical final moments as captured by the jet's two black boxes, which recorded sounds in the cockpit and flight data. He said the crew had a verbal reaction, with the data recorder indicating the airplane beginning to increase its pitch. Sounds of impact were audible about 1 second later, followed by the end of the recording. That's always a creepy part of the thing to have to listen to, but you know, you got to hand it to these NTSB investigators. That's a creepy job, a very creepy job. The things they have to see, and the things that they have to sift through, including human bodies. Surely, they don't sleep all that well all the time. And finally, an FAA report disclosed that a single controller was managing both helicopter and plane traffic at the time of the incident. Is that a factor? Don't know. Yet. But while these responsibilities are usually split between two individuals, the airport typically and routinely consolidates them into one position after 9:30 p.m. when traffic diminishes. News was starting to get out in a big way Wednesday night about that D.C. plane and helicopter crash, that collision. And at that moment, as the news was just getting out, CNN analyst Bakari Sellers rushed to politicize the disaster by attempting to pin the blame on President Trump. And he did it through a rather quickly crafted social media post. He shared a screenshot of a Democratic press release about Trump's alleged hiring freeze of air traffic controllers, captioning it 8 days ago. So this implied that President Trump was responsible for the collision that happened mere hours before. Well, as you can guess, the backlash was pretty quick and severe. Because right now, we have a lot of big, big Trump supporters. So this assumption that the mainstream media has that they're on the majority side is very, very wrong. And it's not a safe assumption for them to be making right now. So one social media user noted, "You deleted the post because dozens of Americans are currently being fished out of the Potomac. And rather than have reverence for the victims, you chose to dishonestly and despicably blame Donald Trump." Now, within 2 hours of his initial post, Sellers was forced to delete it, and then he issued an apology admitting, "I effed up, I own that." And he acknowledged that politics at this point does not matter compared to the human tragedy unfolding. Too bad that he couldn't have been professional enough to understand that before heading to social media. But the reality painted a very different picture from Sellers' initial claims, because according to official documents, Trump's executive order specifically exempted positions related to public safety, including air traffic control. A follow-up order had explicitly directed the FAA to maintain merit-based hiring practices. Well, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, who's new in the job too, confirmed Thursday morning that there had been not a breakdown in communication between the military helicopter, the commercial aircraft, and the control tower, directly contradicting the rushed narrative pushed by some media figures. I'm sure that sounds familiar, doesn't it? Let's head to the comedy corner and Bill Engvall.
I'm at the archery range. I had little field tips on my arrows. I shot my bow and arrow for about an hour. Put them in the back of the truck, drove home. Got to the house, took the bow and arrows out of the back of the truck, and I'm walking up the driveway, and right there is one of my son's old basketballs just laying in the dirt. And I thought to myself, wonder if a fella could shoot an arrow through a basketball. I took an arrow, I drew back. Okay, y'all, I could have done this 10,000 times and I'd have popped that basketball. But because I had field tips on my arrows, when the arrow hit the basketball, it hit one of the seams so perfectly, the arrow shot straight back up and the knock laid my cheek open right here. I got a flap of skin hanging, I'm bleeding, I walk in the house and Gail's like, "What the hell?" I said, "His basketball was right there." You know what? You tell me what grown man wouldn't have looked at that basketball and thought to himself, "I wonder if I can shoot an arrow through a basketball." She goes, "I'll tell you who, Bill, nobody. Nobody but you. You're like a 9-year-old. I swear to God you're gonna put me in a home." And I'm like, "Do you think we could finish this later? Because I'm feeling a little lightheaded right now." So she gives me a dish towel. I'm holding this flap of skin against my face. It's soaked with blood. She's driving me to the hospital. Of course, the whole way there is just... And I kept thinking, why couldn't the arrow have hit me in the ear? We get to the hospital. I walk through the emergency room doors and I hear, "Good God, the dumbest man on the planet is back. You are putting my kid through college." It's like where we live right now, behind our house is about a 40, 50 acre plot of woods. And beyond that's another neighborhood, but I don't know those folks. Probably for their benefit. But my next door neighbor on the other side, Luke, he puts a game camera out in the woods behind our house and he takes pictures of the deer and elk and bear that walk by and then he posts it on his Facebook page. Well, one night I got an idea. I thought it'd be funny if I got a Bigfoot outfit. Come on, that's genius. I'd get that Bigfoot outfit and walk in front of his game camera like, just to be there when he's going through his pictures, he goes, "Yeah, that's an elk, that's a bear, there's Bigfoot, there's..." Oh my God! Well, what we've learned here tonight is that when I get an idea, I don't really think it through. I just kind of roll with it. So I went into town, went to the costume shop, but they did not have a Bigfoot outfit. I know. But they did have a movie quality Batman outfit. And I remember thinking, that is a gift from God right there. How much funnier would that be? He's flipping through his pictures and there's Batman? Hell yes. And this thing was awesome. It had the cape, the mask, the little eyepieces, the shorts, the tool belt, the tights, the boots, everything, gloves. And so I wanted to do it at night. So the picture was kind of grainy, so he couldn't really see it was me. Last June, I'm sitting in my den, 6 o'clock in the evening. dressed as Batman. And Gail walked by.
Have a wonderful Wednesday. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on tomorrow's Bombastic Blogcast. Remember, no such thing as spare change, free lunch, or too much horsepower. And be sure to take some time today just to thank the good Lord that you're an American.
You mean that's it?
See you tomorrow, G-Man.